I guess it's 4, 3, 2, 1. It's afternoon. Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Peter Davidson. I'm a Deputy Dean of Strategic Initiatives at Scalia School of Law, George Mason University, and welcome you all here this morning. My colleague Stuart and other folks here, there's Stuart out there, and other folks, Aaron and Caitlin from George Mason are here making this possible as well, so we want to thank them. We have some great experts here on our panel today. Elizabeth Cantor on my left, and we have Andrew Friedman on my right, who I think both have distinguished careers in this space and can provide a lot of real-life litigation and other types of experience in the data breach area. So I'd like to jump in. One thing, to just give you a little history on myself as well, I have been in government and the private sector kind of back and forth throughout my career. I spent 14 years running government relations at Verizon, so I got a lot of exposure to the types of things they were able to see on their network. We had a former FBI and a former Secret Service person working at Verizon, working on a lot of these data breach issues on a daily basis, so I have a little bit of exposure from that. And then I've done some work both on, I was most recently the General Counsel of the Commerce Department and at NTIA and a lot of the divisions of Commerce, including NIST, which has a cybersecurity framework and a privacy framework now. So that's enough to say that I know enough to be dangerous, but I'm not an expert. I'm a water skier, not a diver. And so that's a perfect position for a moderator to take. So what I'm going to do is ask provocative questions of our experts. But before we get into kind of the hot topics of the day, what I thought we could do is I saw the list of folks in the audience, and so we've got a great array of people from different areas, both in the legislative branch and the executive and the private sector. So I thought we could take a couple minutes at the very beginning to kind of level set on the state of play on data breach. And so I'm going to ask our experts to kind of take a couple minutes and start with that. Before I do that, though, one of the things that we talked about in preparing for this panel is that the concept of data breach itself really lives and exists in a broader context of privacy, cybersecurity, a lot of the other issues that are kind of all mixed up in these. So it's not very, it's not easy to say there's a distinct, you know, data breach topic. But what we're going to try to do is focus as best we can on data breach as such, understanding that we can bleed over into these other areas too. And when we talk about legislative solutions, we can talk about, you know, what might be included in a package, and there's a lot of issues there too, so we'll talk about that. So at that, let me start by asking Andrew to give a little bit of a state of play and kind of a litigation front right now. Andrew.
Sure, thanks, Peter. Can everybody hear me? Okay. My name is Andy Friedman. Peter said I work at a law firm here in town. It does mostly class action work. And so we bring class actions on behalf of people that have had their data breached through some corporate entity. And they've had what we call personally identifiable information stolen. That's exactly what you think it is. PII, as we call it, is everything from your name, your address, your date of birth, social security numbers, telephone numbers, whether landlines or cell phones, banking information, bank account numbers, your place of birth, your nationality, your gender, employer information, and occasionally even medical IDs. So these class actions are really not against the hackers per se. They are against the company that permitted the exfiltration of the data to the hacker in the first place. So all that PII, why is it important? Why is it valuable? Well, as you can probably learn, and Peter will talk about it, maybe Libby will talk about it as well, all this data combined with your name can be combined to create an identity, the combination, and it will cause economic harm, or could cause economic harm. You can open up credit card numbers, tax refunds, you can actually open up loans in other people's names. So the cases that we bring are almost always in federal court. The reason for that is very simple. You're talking about class members that are from virtually all 50 states, and you're going against a company or companies in another state. So that's usually the jurisdictional hook to get into federal court. But there is no one law that applies. There's not a federal law, and I know that's something we'll probably talk about a little later today. These cases are usually, at base, they're really negligence cases. The simple way to look at it is there was a standard of care for cybersecurity. A company didn't meet that standard of care, and as a result, the personally identifiable information was taken, was exfiltrated. Occasionally, there's contract law. That means the company either made an explicit or an implicit promise to protect your data, your PII. Occasionally, there are state deceptive act claims. There are also data breach statutes, but those are usually notice types. You have to notify people whose information has been hacked within a certain number of days. And I think Libby's going to talk about the CCPA, the new California Act, that just went into use. Using those different common law elements is really not a problem. The biggest problem we're facing now is one of standing. When I talk about standing, that's just a fancy way to say, is it an injury that the court will accept as a true injury in fact? For a federal court to have jurisdiction, that's sort of the first hurdle that they have to meet. They have to show that the named plaintiffs, not all the class members, but the named plaintiffs, the class representatives, have the standing, that they have an injury in fact. Right now, there's a split amongst the courts as to what constitutes standing. Almost all of the courts will recognize that, okay, if you had your information hacked and somebody opened up a loan in your name and you suffered damages, that's an injury in fact. That's easy. The problem is, from a class perspective, most people don't have that out-of-pocket loss, at least not close to the date of the first exfiltration of data. So there are other injuries that we allege in the cases. For example, we have people that will testify, experts that will testify to a certainty that every time your information is taken, even if it was hacked in a prior data breach, every subsequent time that it's hacked, that means that increases geometrically the likelihood that you're going to suffer a fraud or an identity fraud. So even without social security numbers, when your PII is taken, when that's taken as a unit with all these other data points, that increases the likelihood that you're going to suffer identity theft. You'll hear about phishing. Everybody knows about phishing. Well, what do people fish for? One of the things they fish for is they already have, say, for example, your date of birth or your the place where you're born, your hometown. If they have that, that's usually what people use in their passwords to retrieve their passwords. So it's an easy phishing exercise for an experienced hacker armed with that information, but then go back to you and get more information. So they basically assemble all this information. So that is sort of what we think is the basic building block of damages, or what we think should be standing. But not all courts recognize that. So some courts will say, well, the likelihood of your suffering identity theft in the future or identity fraud is not a damage. It's not an injury that we, the court, is likely to recognize. So that's an issue. Another type of damage is the loss of the value of your PII. Your personally identifiable information has a value. In fact, if you go on the dark web, people are selling it. They're selling their data. They sell your social security number for X dollars. So that's a value that you're losing. And every time somebody hacks that, you are losing the value, some value of that. One other type of damage that we sometimes allege, and again, is not always recognized by the courts, is something called benefit of the bargain damages. So in contract, if somebody says, I'm going to give you X, I'm going to give you this widget, and it's going to have data security, good cyber security. That means you paid a dollar amount for this. But you didn't actually get the value of that. You got something less than that. You got that goods or service that was worth something less than that because you bought a service that really didn't have the promised cybersecurity. So right now, the courts are really split on those standing issues, and that's a problem. And it causes some consternation for consumers, and it makes for some uneven laws.
So Andrew, standing is the kind of the main thing that you're looking at. Are there any other categories in the litigation front that you would point to as a major issues right now on the splits and circuits or whatever the areas of controversy?
I'd say that's the biggest one in the circuits right now. There are others. Class certification is always difficult in virtually any kind of case. It's an uphill battle, but the notion that some judges will say, well, even though negligence is really the same, pretty much the same standards in every state, some judges will say, well, no, that makes it unmanageable. We can't have 50 different negligence laws. That's common law, that's judgment law. And there are inconsistencies between state A and state B, and so that makes it difficult. That is not maybe unique to data breach cases, but most class actions are on hold.
Okay, great. Well, thank you, Andrew, for that. Libby, do you want to start a little bit with the level set on where we are kind of on the legislative front and where states are in terms of addressing these issues, and maybe touch on California a little bit too, since we're still in January, barely in January. Yeah.
Sure. So briefly, by way of introduction, my name is Libby Kanner, and I'm a partner in the privacy and cyber practice at a firm called Covington & Burling. Andy and I have different perspectives in a few different ways. The first is that I'm not a litigator, I'm an advisory lawyer. So I spent a lot of time helping different companies even before there's been a data breach. A lot of these companies take data security very, very seriously for brand reasons and for legal risk reasons. And so spent a lot of time developing information security programs, developing incident response plans, investing in what the processes and policies ought to be internally to help ensure that a data breach doesn't happen, or if it happens, the company can respond in an appropriate and expeditious way to notify consumers promptly in accordance with the breach notice laws that exist in all 50 states. And to frankly remediate quickly, so limit the amount, any harm that could arise to consumers by containing it quickly and things like that. And then when and if a breach does happen, we counsel on and spend a lot of time on helping them remediate quickly, so advising on what the notice obligations are. So there are 50 different laws in 50 different states, and some of them define personal data differently for purposes of breach notice. So North Dakota, name plus date of birth triggers notice to consumers. That's not the case in any other state. A handful of states like California and Texas, notice is triggered for name plus health information. A handful of states, name plus, if you have email address and password, that triggers notice, but not in other places. Even where notice isn't required in different state laws, we talk through with clients about whether they want to provide notice anyways, because maybe there's some risk of harm to the person and they want to provide notice to limit, put individuals on notice to limit risk of harm. And then, fortunately, very few of my clients ever are sort of subject to litigation, but when there is litigation, and we're involved, it's typically on the defense side, right? Whereas Andy comes at this from the perspective of the plaintiff or the individuals who are harmed. So when clients are sued, we're involved in thinking through standing issues, but thinking through why maybe plaintiffs weren't harmed in a particular case such that they don't have standing. I will say from the advisory perspective and thinking through the regulatory risks, right? So whether to notify state attorneys general and whether to notify the Federal Trade Commission Act, the Federal Trade Commission, not the Act, one factor in the calculus is the litigation risk that hangs out there, right? So when you're notifying individuals and you're notifying regulators, even because you think that's the right thing to do, or you want to notify individuals to protect yourself, one risk or one sort of counter argument when you might otherwise be inclined to provide notice is, does it increase the litigation risk? I'm not obligated by law, I think, to notify, but if I do notify, does that increase my litigation exposure in some way? So that's kind of the lens I see through it. I didn't really intend that by way of biography, but more so you kind of know the different perspectives. And also, I think it sort of highlights the fact that there is sort of a lot of, even before the California Consumer Privacy Act, there's a lot out there in terms of positive law that influences how companies are thinking about these issues.
Libby, do you want to just give a couple minutes on California, seeing as that's kind of the most recent development in the space?
Sure. So as many of you may have noticed, who got in December or January 1st a flurry of emails saying all the companies you do business with have updated their privacy policies. In June of 2018, California enacted a new law, the California Consumer Privacy Act. And as Peter alluded to, a lot of the statute is privacy focused, right? It relates to providing notice through online privacy policies, giving consumers right to access and delete and opt out of sale of their information. At its core, it's not a data security law or a data breach notice law. But a little bit of backstory on the CCPA is that it started out as a ballot initiative. And the sponsor of the ballot initiative had included a broad private right of action in the ballot initiative that would have made actionable any violation of those privacy requirements. So if you didn't comply with access requests or deletion requests in a compliant way, consumers would have had a private right of action. There was a negotiated compromise where that sponsor of the ballot initiative agreed to withdraw the ballot initiative in exchange for California enacting what became the CCPA. And it was important to have a private right of action for the sponsor, Alistair McTaggart, and some of the consumer groups he was aligned with. And so the negotiated solution was a compromise that didn't include a broad private right of action. It didn't say any violation of the statute is now actionable with statutory damages, but it did create a new private right of action for certain kinds of data breaches. And it's not, you know, for all data breaches, there has to be a compromise of personal information as it's defined in California's breach notice statute. So the CCPA, for most purposes, has a really broad definition of personal information that includes IP addresses and cookie IDs and probabilistic identifiers. The personal information that triggers the breach notice statute really is focused on things like name plus health information or name plus social security number, the things that might require notice under the statute. It's only if the data is unencrypted or unredacted. The private right of action is only available if there's been unreasonable security. So there's not a strict liability standard. There's also not a very high culpability standard. The standard is reasonableness. And then fourthly, and I think most interestingly, because who knows how this will be interpreted, there's language saying that plaintiffs can't, in order to bring a complaint under the statute, you have to give the company 30 days notice and the opportunity to cure. And who knows what that means in the context of a data breach. So I think there's an argument that if the company takes steps to prevent the a similar breach from happening again, that the breach has been cured. But I imagine that Andy has other arguments, and maybe I should take this moment to say something I intended to say up front, which is that all the views expressed here are my own and not my clients. So I think that's sort of an interesting feature of the law too, and it exists under other California statutes, but hasn't been interpreted in the context of this one. And maybe I'll briefly say what's happening in some of the other states.
Yeah.
So what's really interesting is now California is in effect. The ink's not quite yet dry. And a whole bunch of other states are now considering their own comprehensive privacy laws. And I'm not going to elaborate at length unless there are questions about it, but because the focus of most of those laws is around these privacy issues. But, of course, private rights of action are kind of one of the battlegrounds in each of these different states, and whether the statute should include private rights of action. So last year we saw about 20 different states with these proposals. Some of those states have reintroduced legislation in 2020. Other new states like New Hampshire and Virginia have proposed their own bills, and some of these laws have broad private rights of action. So Massachusetts and Maryland and other states are proposing very broad private rights of action for any privacy violation, not just the data security piece. And then some, like New Hampshire, have a CCPA copycat law. So the private right of action is is the CCPA private right of action, and it's focused on the data breach piece.
Great. Well, thanks, Libby. Andy, do you have any kind of thoughts on how the California legislation is going to impact litigation, or any kind of thoughts on development in that area and other states enacting new laws?
Sure. Well, I'm fascinated. I'm actually happy to hear Libby's is maybe confused about the cure provision as I am. It's so new, it hasn't been interpreted by any judge yet, any court. It will happen, obviously. Having a great thing from our perspective that it does, it not only gives a private right of action to people that have suffered a data breach, or suffered at the hands of a data breach, but it has statutory damages, and that is a big deal. There are very, very few statutes anywhere on the books that offer a statutory damage. So the statutory damages, I think, are a minimum of $100 to $750 per person. And that's one of the big problems in all class actions. You have to come up with a common damage model for everybody in the class. You're not doing the case on an individual basis. It's impossible. It's not a viable action to do that way. Here, when you have a statutory damage, you're basically saying, at a minimum, Your Honor, you've got $100 for every person that was impacted. So that really is a game changer.
Particularly on the standing front, too. That takes a lot of the issues out of the way in standing.
Absolutely. I'm sure we'll hear from defense counsel on that at some point, that they have what's known as a Spokio issue on that. But yes, there's a statutory damage which gives you, most courts will say that gives you standing because you have an injury. It's a statutorily created injury. The cure provision is kind of scratching my head over. Again, I've read it. Hasn't been interpreted yet. I haven't read the legislative history. On the flip side, I don't do any advisory work. Libby's the expert on that. I'm a litigator. And so I haven't gone back and rolled up my sleeves to do that. It will happen at some point when and if we're involved in a case that has the CCPA. But a cure provision simply means, generally, we fix the problem. Well, the first thing that happens after a data breach is every company worth its salt, even if they were, even if they were incredibly negligent in the first place to allow a breach, the very first thing they're going to do is to fix that so it doesn't keep going, because otherwise they have no end to their injuries of the class members. So if that's the cure, it just doesn't make any sense. The real damage is that information is already left. The horse has left the barn. So your information is probably on the dark web at that point. So I don't see how that's cured, stopping the further flow of exfiltrated data. So that's going to be a big question. In terms of how other states are doing this, I hope other states adopt this. It seems like it's a consumer-oriented law. I think I didn't understand the whole compromise that went on there, but it looks like it's a good law, and the devil's going to be in the details as to how it's interpreted.
Well, let's go there then. So California adopts a law. A lot of big online companies in California. A lot of consumers in California. Libby, is this another example of a catalytic converter situation, or where one state is kind of defining the standard for the rest of the country? Question one, and then question two. We'll get both people to answer this. Is that desirable? Should we be having a state-by-state solution to this? Or would it be preferable to have Congress step in, or a regulator, or whoever it would be, and provide a national standard?
I'll give a few thoughts. So, and there's kind of a descriptive and a normative element to that question. So in terms of the sort of descriptive element, what is happening? And then I'll turn to the normative, what should happen. So as I mentioned, a number of states have copycat proposals. And I, with no disrespect to anyone in a state legislature, I think one objective fact is that many state legislatures have many fewer resources than California or the federal Congress. And so as a pragmatic matter, there's probably some momentum to just adopt a law that's been baked already. On the other hand, there are different versions of comprehensive privacy laws in different states. And interestingly, I would bet, you know, a few Hershey Kisses that the next state to adopt something is Washington State, where there also are a number of tech companies. And they have a slightly different model. So they have some common elements to the CCPA. There are restrictions. Consumers have the right to opt out of sales of data. They have access and deletion rights. But it actually is drafted somewhat differently. It has some more similarities to GDPR in Europe in terms of some of the additional rights that consumers would have. It has facial recognition components at this point, although those, you know, may not be addressed in the same bill. So I think there could be kind of two models out there that different states could pick and choose from. And there also are other efforts. So there are I'm blanking on the name of this organization, but the same organization that works on the Uniform Code of Conduct for different state law purposes is working on a model state law. And, you know, they probably will start with California since that's the first adopter, but that may not, you know, conceptually, I take Andy's point that it seems like a positive thing for consumers, but this was a law because of this compromise I mentioned that was drafted in 1 week. So the ballot initiative had to be withdrawn by June 30th in order for this compromise to work out. And that meant, and someone had the idea to do this the week before, and that meant that the ballot initiative was dramatically amended and became a statute in 1 week. And so there are a lot of interpretive ambiguities under the state law. There are also a lot of issues where the statute directs the Attorney General to make rules, and we don't have final rules yet. And of course, if all 50 states have that same paradigm, and even if the statutes are the same, you have 50 different attorneys general adopting rules, you don't have a common standard in those different states. So there are a lot of ambiguities, and I'll mention, you know, there's not a clear exception for not providing trade secrets in response to an access request. There's a lot of confusion about how you verify consumers before you give them the information you've collected about them, so as to avoid creating data security risk, right? You don't want to, I shouldn't be able to fish Andy's email address, submit it to company A, and then get all of Andy's information without being adequately verified, but the standard for verification is very unclear. So I think there's a lot of ambiguities in the law, and so I do think it's probably a good thing that other states are experimenting and fine-tuning the statute rather than just copying and pasting it. I also think that as more states, one of the issues in Washington and Illinois, where a bill passed last year the Illinois House but didn't pass the Illinois Senate, is the scope of the private right of action. And for better or worse, that's a game changer, right?
In so terms Illinois of Illinois has a broader private right of action?
As introduced, it did not, but one of the reasons that the Senate didn't adopt it was the scope of the private right of action.
Okay.
And so I do think that as more of these states enact slightly different versions, and especially to the extent some of them have broader private rights of action, there will be a lot of even more pressure than there already is to do something federally.
So, Andy, what I think I hear Libby saying is that we've been doing a little bit of constitutional history here in Washington for the last couple of weeks. So here we have a perfect example of federalism. We have states experimenting with different models and different approaches, and we can kind of see what works and what doesn't work, but eventually it will probably be advantageous both for consumers and businesses to have a national standard. Is that putting too many words in your mouth, or is that...
I think it depends on what the other states do, but if the states do what I expect them to do, I suspect it will become a little the other practical piece of this, right, is that if I'm a company and I have an e-commerce site, I don't really treat people in one state differently than people in other states. And I'm not going to fearmonger and say that I think these laws are going to require me to do patently inconsistent things. I do think that's a talking point. Like, you know, theoretically, Massachusetts could say you can never put this in your privacy policy, and California says you have to put this in your privacy policy. And I think that's I think it's unlikely to happen, but it could happen, and obviously a federal standard is important in that case. But I do think what's more likely is that, you know, the framework doesn't make sense. It's kind of a Frankenstein of different requirements with different ethoses. And it would make sense to have one federal standard where there's alignment on what the ethos is. I also think, I think that's kind of one important point.
Okay. Andy, what are your thoughts on federalism?
Well, interesting. There's a saying, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, right? It doesn't work perfectly now, but the notion that states can make their own laws and protect their own consumers and citizens the way that they choose, I think has a great appeal, and it's worked, and it makes for creative solutions through the legislature. So I start there. I don't think there's a real problem. Yeah, and a federal statute in and of itself, I think, could make sense, but it's got to have some real protections baked into it. I understand what they'd be saying, and yeah, if there are other copycats, I think the proof will be in the pudding there too. We'll see what happens with the other states. How do they interpret the CCPA? Do they add something really draconian? Do they expand it slightly? It may not be a hodgepodge of different items. But if we're going to have a federal statute, it's got to be something that is consumer oriented. It's got to be something that really has both sides in mind. It can't be a statute that is designed to immunize companies from liability. It's got to have a private right of action. It's got to be able to do class actions, because that's the only way you can bring cases. It should have a statutory damage the way the CCPA is. Most importantly, I would say, it shouldn't preempt the states. These states have fought long and hard. I understand the way this one was cooked up, but I think from what I read, there was a lot going on for the CCPA for a long time. So it wasn't made out of whole cloth a week before. It may have, you know, like any other legislation, may have had some compromise at the end. But it's really important that whatever federal statute, if there is a federal statute, doesn't say, well, this is it. If anything that runs afoul of this statute cannot be enforced, because that is usually antithetical to real consumerism. So I think that's one of the things
that we're... So Libby, Andy says, Andy wants a floor, but not a ceiling. What do you think about that?